This is the very sad state we're in Bitcoin, where we have a compromised Bitcoin core.
At least when someone is spinning up a new node, they actually have to pause and assess, what is it that I want to run? Where do my values lie?
Michael Saylor's become a shitcoiner, spending years talking about Bitcoin as being ethical money and Ethereum as being garbage, that he's now actually retweeting Ethereum garbage.
My belief of Bitcoin is that you can buy as much Bitcoin as you want, and you can even take it into self-custody, and you are not a participant in the network unless you are also running a node.
Bitcoin 10 and Bitcoin knots people's messages. You cannot do that as devs. This is not how Bitcoin works. Bitcoin is decentralized. You need to get node runners' permission. And so we're going to push back against you.
Today on the show, I have Matt Kratter. Matt has been quite the controversial figure in the BIP 110 knots versus core debate, and he has a very strong opinion, walks through the history of core, why he thinks it's been corrupted. This is a fascinating episode. I think you're really going to learn a lot and enjoy the show. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Matt here. Matt, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Good to be here, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
I'm excited to chat. You have educated a lot of people on Bitcoin through Bitcoin University, and I think you've got a lot to share here. I told you before we clicked record, I'm going to sort of play devil's advocate against some of your points, because I think it'll give you an opportunity to explain to the people who maybe have objections, aren't really clear what's going on. First, why don't you give a background, a brief background on spam on Bitcoin, what happened during sort of these node wars that continue to persist, and then maybe we can talk about why you think core devs are compromised and not merely misaligned with you.
I think that's a good question. So I'll actually start with the second part of the question first, and then I'll tackle the first part. So it's always hard to know when people are compromised. They don't come right out and say, I'm compromised, obviously. And they're not like Dr. Evil. That's just in Hollywood and on TV. And so this is something that always needs to be inferred. And I think a good context, especially for your viewers and, you know, people who've lived through the last 6 years. And, you know, I may offend some people with this analogy, but I think a lot of the history is sort of becoming clear now. But it would be an example like Fauci at the beginning of COVID. And, you know, Fauci, who's here to, worry about the health of the American people, et cetera. And I didn't even know who he was until 2020. And I thought he actually did want to save my grandmother or whatever, even though she passed away many decades ago. But then, so how do you know? How do you know there's some weird stuff happening? Obviously, COVID was a rough time for many people, but it did kind of wake a lot of people up, which I think is interesting, and it opened people's eyes to the idea that, you know, the good guys, the smiling guys on TV, sometimes can be malicious, and so it became clear to many of us that Fauci was somehow compromised, and why did we know that? Because the gaslighting. The changing narratives, masks don't work, masks do work, you should wear two masks, you should wear a mask when you're checking in at a restaurant, but once you get to your table, you can take the mask off, but you can't go to the beach even with a mask. You can go outside though without a mask if you're protesting certain political things. And then there's the safe and effective vaccine where it's safe and effective, but the unvaccinated are still a threat to the vaccinated, even though the vaccine is safe and effective. So this is obviously, I mean, it's a really blatant example. Then, of course, it came out that Fauci was indirectly funding the coronavirus lab in Wuhan, et cetera, and the Chinese and the Americans were working together. And so I think that's a helpful template. And the whole time, I mean, Fauci was never a bad guy. He was always smiling on TV, and he's just this nice grandfatherly figure. And that's a good way to, you know, you don't put someone who looks like Dr. Evil to do the project. You have to do someone who's, you know, a serious scientist and has been around for decades, et cetera. And so I think in terms of answering this question about Bitcoin Core being compromised, there's similar clues, because in the last 12 months, we've seen quite a bit of gaslighting, changing of narratives. And one way to understand that is to rewind back to the early days when Satoshi was still around at the project. And there's a famous exchange he had with Gavin Andreessen, who's the guy that Satoshi basically passed on the repo keys to. And Gavin was saying, my evil little mind imagines embedding Lady Gaga videos in the blockchain. And Satoshi basically said, we have transaction fees to fight that. And then there's other stuff we can do if needed. So Satoshi, unlike modern Bitcoin core devs, he knew what spam was. and he was willing to fight it. He obviously knew that Bitcoin was a monetary network. And so we have this history, and this is why it's important always to study history. It's nice with Bitcoin because we're still very early in the history. It hasn't even been two decades. So you can go back, as I've done, and you can read early exchanges like that. And you can follow the history of spam or non-monetary data, arbitrary data, basically things that don't make Bitcoin better money, and how are these things always treated. And so the first episode of the spam wars really took place in 2013, 2014, and kind of wrapped up in 2015. There are a number of projects, for example, Eric Voorhees, I think it was him. He had Satoshi Dice. And so basically this was like casino gambling on the blockchain, and it was producing all this Bitcoin dust, these dust UTXOs. You had the Counterparty guys, the Colored Coin guys, the Omni guys, all these people who thought it'd be cool to put shitcoins on Bitcoin, or to put Wall Street assets, to somehow real world assets on the blockchain. And the thing is, in Bitcoin, one of the useful things about reading this history is you'll see these things get reintroduced 10 years later, and everyone's like, so this is what happened with ordinals and inscriptions, which are basically Bitcoin NFTs, and BRC20 tokens, which are shitcoins on Bitcoin. These things all came back in 2023, and there's nothing new about them. This had been attempted before. But what happened in 2014 is we had a very cypherpunk group of people in Bitcoin, and certainly in Bitcoin Core. And these were people who hadn't gotten into, they weren't from Wall Street. They weren't interested in getting rich, most of them. They thought it was cool. Bitcoin was cool. They wanted to buy drugs with it on the Silk Road. And they were kind of hacker types. And many of these people never ended up getting rich from Bitcoin because they just used it as, you know, played around with it and used it as a medium of exchange, et cetera. You know, Bitcoin is a threat to the system. And so the system has been attacking it since the very early days. In fact, the same Gavin Andreessen we were talking about decided one day for some reason just to go visit the CIA. And this really upset Satoshi. And Satoshi was basically on his way out at that point saying, I don't want part of this. So it's important to understand that Bitcoin is a very important project that intel agencies, central bankers, politicians, deep state actors, all the bad guys in the world, and also all the good guys in the world know how important it is. So this is the battleground. We won the spam wars in 2013, 2014, 2015 because we had Bitcoin Core devs, and Bitcoin Core is really just the node software that Bitcoiners run, or that used to run, and now people are sort of migrating away from it to Bitcoin Knots because of the developments I'm about to tell you. But basically, we had Bitcoin Core devs back then who understood that Bitcoin was money and were willing to defend it as such, and willing to defend the blockchain. And one of the basic principles of Bitcoin culture is that this blockchain is immutable, and it's going to be around forever. And in future node runners, 100 years from now, if you've ever spun up a node, and I know you guys help a lot of people spin up nodes, you know you have to basically download the history from 2009, and your node validates everything and checks everything. And so the basic philosophy or the basic culture in Bitcoin always was, don't be an asshole. You know, this is sort of the common, you've heard of tragedy of the commons. This is the common blockchain, and we want this to be around forever, and we want to separate money from state. And so people doing gambling, doing casino games on Bitcoin, this is frivolous. It's, you know, it's funny for like 5 seconds, but then when you realize that central bankers hate us and want to put us in a digital prison and all these things are coming and give us CBDCs, you realize that maybe we should really optimize Bitcoin for being the best money that's possible. And so these Bitcoin Core devs fought spam. They basically drove, and one of the guys who wanted to do complex smart contracts, Turing complete stuff on Bitcoin was a guy named Vitalik Buterin, who started Bitcoin Magazine. And he had actually already done a quantum scam at that point. So these quantum scams, you know, keep coming back. It's always a good way to scare people and make money. But he had this idea of putting smart contracts on Bitcoin and really, really bloating it. And the Bitcoin Core devs and the Bitcoin community said, no way, not interested. And so the Bitcoin community filtered out. I like to say we filtered out Vitalik Buterin. And you can go find, I talk about his tweets in my videos. You can go see where he said, basically, I decided not to build on Bitcoin because of hostility from Bitcoin Core devs. And so there's basically this place in Bitcoin that was established in 2014 called OpReturn. And it's a place to put a small amount of arbitrary data. For example, a hash of a larger document. You could hash the Declaration of Independence, for example, and stick it in there. And it's still just 40 bytes, or it started off as 40 bytes and then went up to 80 bytes. But this has always been a place not for monetary stuff, but just for sort of proof of existence. So you can prove you have a legal document, you hash it, you put the hash in there, and in a transaction, only takes up 40, 80 bytes, a very small amount of data.
Matt, was that a compromise that was made amongst developers that, hey, we're going to experience some level of this, let's create this small amount of arbitrary data, this OpReturn for that specific purpose?
Well, it was,
and then that was supposed to be it.
I think that's a good way of putting it, though. I wouldn't say it was a compromise with spammers. It was a compromise with ethical people who wanted to. So for example, you might want to hash a business document or something to prove that it existed at a certain point in time. And then you stick it in the blockchain and everyone knows, because a hash is basically a unique fingerprint of a document. So it sort of functions as proof of existence at a certain point in time. And because the Bitcoin blockchain can never be rewritten, it serves that purpose. So there was a small accommodation made, and this is a problem in criminal context as well. California did something like this that's quite notorious, where it's like you're only allowed to shoplift $1,000 worth of goods. And so if you give someone, it started off as 40 bytes, and then they raised it to 80 bytes. They moved it back and forth a couple times. And it was this compromise, but it wasn't big enough for Vitalik. And so he left, and all his buddies left, and they went and created an idiot container called Ethereum, where all the scams, all the shit coins, everything happened for about a decade. So it was very nice in Bitcoin, because all those people who wanted to play games and they weren't serious about Bitcoin as money and separating money and state, they went over to Ethereum. So that was 2014, call it. And we had this almost a decade of peace. We had the block size wars. But there was no one that was more debate of about monetary transactions in the blockchain and how big the blocks would be. But that whole faction that wanted to do silly things on the blockchain and basically pollute the blockchain, because again, this is stuff that some poor family is going to have to download 100 years from now. So it's actually not that funny, and it makes it harder to run a node, more expensive to run a node. So we had this period of peace, and inevitably, there was turnover in Bitcoin Core dev circles, and a lot of the people just sort of aged out. A lot of the people, OG Bitcoiners, a lot of them, or a fair number, obviously got quite rich and, didn't want to have to, had decided to move on with their lives and start families, etc. I imagine it's quite stressful working on Bitcoin Core or Bitcoin Knot software, because there's a lot of money riding on it, and this is it's a very important project. So there was dev turnover, and we began to see really in 2019, 2020, there was a push to replace some of these devs who had retired or moved on to other things. And as part of this, there was this idea, which started off as a good idea, like these things normally do, that we should fund Bitcoin core devs. And there was some funding before, going back a few years, but there was a real push to get younger devs and to sort of grow the pipeline of new devs, because it's such a niche thing. Like, how many people in 2019, wanted to become Bitcoiners or even cared about Bitcoin? And then of that set, how many people wanted to work on the actual node software, which you don't get rich doing? It's very tedious. It's very stressful. And the other thing we had happening back then was Craig Wright, who is this fake Toshi, the scammer who pretended to be Satoshi. He was suing all the Bitcoin Core devs. So it was a very stressful time. And that's one reason a bunch of them retired and moved on, because it's like, why do we need this? So this push to bring in new devs started with good intentions. Unfortunately, it ended up recruiting a lot of very young devs who didn't have the same sort of cypherpunk ethos, and for obvious reasons, because some of them had just graduated from college, they didn't have any money. Like, none of us have that much money or any money when we graduate from college. We usually just have debt instead. It's one thing if you go and volunteer and work on Bitcoin Core because you have 5,000 Bitcoin, and you're going to have a very different attitude to what happens with Bitcoin. you're not going to be making jokes about it and, you know, joking about wallets being deleted and stuff. But if you're just fresh out of college, maybe this is just another programming job for you and you can make, you know, $300,000, $400,000. And so it's selected for a group of people who are fairly young, seem to like living in blue cities, had gone to fairly left-wing universities, though obviously all the universities are fairly left-wing right now. And so these people didn't have the same ethos, and they didn't have their whole net worth in Bitcoin. Most of these people didn't even care about being paid in Bitcoin. They're being paid in fiat. And they were also living together in big blue cities, mainly San Francisco at the Presidio, New York City, Midtown, Manhattan, and London. And John Attack is a Bitcoin Core dev who's talked about this. He's done some great interviews with Bob Burnett and Daniel Prince and Knut Svanholm. So basically, they selected for a certain type of person, someone who's fairly young, doesn't have a family yet, is fine with living in a box in a city, is willing to comply, for example, with the COVID vax, because obviously you can go work in an office in the early 2020s without having a vaccine passport. And so it unfortunately ended up selecting for people who didn't have the same ethos, the kind of people who just want to live in El Salvador, like out in the wilderness, and are more hacker types and have slightly different politics. I really don't want to make this a left-right thing. Maybe the better way of looking at it is authoritarianism. And so, you know, if the left wants to inject you with things or the right wants to inject you with things, this is a problem on both sides. But anyway, so what happened is there was a recurrence of Bitcoin spam, and it was basically brought back because all the shitcoins were dying and the scammers needed something fresh to sell to crypto VCs and to sell to noobs who got wrecked on all these shitcoins. And then they're like, I'm never going to buy a shitcoin again. So the idea was, well, let's put shitcoins on Bitcoin and sort of let it share the aura. And so the shitcoins on Bitcoin were developed, and Bitcoin NFTs, which had been very popular on Ethereum. And these basically began to hit the chain and interfere with monetary transactions and drive up transaction fees. And it also brought a lot of shitcoiners over to Bitcoin, just people with very bad cultural values who didn't care about the blockchain, didn't care about separating money from state, just wanted to do pump and dumps and scam people and get rich. And of course, none of them got rich because they make a lot of money in one pump and dump, but then they'd lose it. So it's just this sort of casino mentality that we'd been shielded from because everyone was on Ethereum doing it. But Ethereum just kept like shooting itself in the foot so many times. And so we basically had these large spam attacks in 2023 and 2024. And anyone who's listening to this who is trying to do transactions then remembers seeing just the massive transaction fees. And these transaction fees were not because everyone was using Bitcoin as money and trying to transact on chain. It was because there were spammers and scammers attacking it. And many of these people were well-respected Bitcoiners who ran Bitcoin conferences and had Bitcoin magazines and were respected in the community, had been around for a while. So it was a very confusing time for many of us. Especially, I'd only been in Bitcoin for about 4 years at that point. So I was trying to make heads or tails of it. People were making arguments like, look how cool it is. We can put the Declaration of Independence on the blockchain. Like, what's more freedom-minded than that? Well, the problem is, you know, you can put the Declaration of Independence in BitTorrent, or you can put it on a satellite and send it to the moon or something, put it on a rocket. There's no reason to put it on the Bitcoin blockchain. Or maybe you can put that, but then that was used to justify putting like pornographic cartoons and just total garbage and bad postmodern art and clip art and just garbage. But unfortunately, the ethos had changed at Bitcoin Core, and because of this dev turnover that I was talking about, and we had sort of a group of people who are much more agnostic about what Bitcoin was for. They were hesitant to say this is for money. They had this sort of postmodern way of looking at the world that they had inherited from perhaps from their undergraduate studies. And so they weren't equipped to fight the spam in the same way. And they basically just laid down and let it happen. And they abandoned this tradition of fighting to keep the blockchain as lean and mean as possible. And many of these same characters who in 2014 and 2015, people like Greg Maxwell and Peter Woola, who are sort of the senior respected devs, even they changed. And I had a quote from Greg Maxwell I just wanted to read here. from 2014. So he, Greg Maxwell has done a lot for Bitcoin. He's been a longtime contributor. He's one of the, you know, easily top three most respected Bitcoin devs living now. And so let me tell you his approach to op return and spam in 2014. This is from the Bitcoin repo discussion or Bitcoin talk. You can Google this, but he writes, "I think op return, which is this place, you know, you put arbitrary data that we were talking about. I think op return has shown itself to be seriously problematic. And we continue to have problems with people believing that storing non-Bitcoin related data in the chain, in the blockchain, is an approved, correct, non-antisocial use of the system. We have people selling insane data storage services, et cetera. It's a bad place to be." So that's Greg Maxwell in 2014, but Greg Maxwell in 2023 to 2026, all of a sudden doesn't believe that protecting the Bitcoin blockchain is that important. And in fact, he's been saying the opposite. He's been saying, like, people who are on my side fighting for this sort of traditional stuff, that, you know, we're the weirdos and we don't understand Bitcoin. And so there's this weird thing you can do where you can use, Greg Maxwell's a genius. He's a very impressive guy who's done a lot for Bitcoin, but he can't really explain why he changed his view. And so you can play this fun game of quoting Greg Maxwell in 2014 to refute him in 2026. And so there's this toxic combination among Bitcoin core devs where the senior devs like Greg Maxwell and Peter Wolle sort of burned out, checked out, rich, and, you know, wanted to kind of work on their own things. And so they weren't pulling the younger devs into line. Younger devs, I've talked about Gloria Zhao, who's no longer with the project, but she was a shitcoiner undergrad at UC Berkeley, who's never really a hacker type. She studied CS apparently in college and then went to work on Bitcoin as just another corporate job. So there's a whole, we probably don't have to go into it here, but there's a whole dating, nepotism, DEI element to this as well. That's quite ugly, where people who are founding and running the nonprofits and giving out money were also dating the female devs. And basically promoting people, these people were pushed up past their ability or past their level of wisdom. And so you had immature Bitcoin devs who, you know, I don't think they're bad people or anything. They're just young and they're being given everything on a silver platter and they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year out of college. And they're getting to hang out with Greg Maxwell and Peter Wolle. Like, it's amazing. It's something that you kind of can make your head big if at some point doing that. So the junior devs like Gloria just had no idea. They were shitcoiners. They actually were teaching how to do shitcoin ICOs at Berkeley as part of their crypto club. So they didn't understand that this was a spam attack and that this was dangerous. And then for some reason, whether because they're checked out or because they're somehow compromised, the senior devs were not pulling them into line. So now we're dealing with a very young group of devs. And there's kind of a core group, which are called the maintainers. These are people who have been given write access to the Bitcoin repo. So they can actually make changes to the code. And theoretically, they're not supposed to make any changes that the community doesn't agree with. But I think one of the red flags is that there were changes made. And there's this metaphor that the Bitcoin core maintainers are like janitors. They're just basically cleaning up the code and making it compatible with new operating systems and fixing bugs. But they became much more activist. And in kind of a weird woke way. So there's all this discussion of Bitcoin Core, like especially during the George Floyd times, that we shouldn't use the word blacklist in our documentation or in our software documentation, because that's somehow, I don't know, that's racist, I guess, calling it a blacklist. So they wanted to call it some other thing. So yeah, just give that as an example of the mentality. Like, you know, we're trying to destroy the central banks. So, and there are all types of people in Bitcoin, and Bitcoiners just, you know, get along with everyone. We're international, we're global. We don't care about skin color. We don't care about gender or politics or anything, as long as you're here to separate money from state. And so this weird stuff began to creep in. And this has happened with other open source projects like Linux and Tor. And it's sort of, I'm not sure exactly why that is, but people have told me about this happening elsewhere. Part of it is just trying to capture these very important things. And it's much easier to capture something in a kind of a sneaky way if it's open source and distributed and decentralized like Bitcoin aims to be. And so we had these spam attacks. The Bitcoin core devs just laid down, and basically the blockchain got completely destroyed and it got filled up with spam. And something called the UTXO set completely blew up from 4 gigabytes to 12 gigabytes. Now, UTXOs, these are chunks of unspent Bitcoin, and they're very important because when a node sees a new transaction, in order to avoid double spending, it has to go quickly check the UTXO set to see, oh, can this chunk of Bitcoin still be spent, or has it already been spent? And so if you're running a Bitcoin node, and I would encourage everyone, run a Bitcoin Knots node, because you'll learn, a lot of this sounds abstract and complicated. When you run your own node, it's really easy to do. You just download the software, it's free, go to bitcoinknots.org, I think it is, or get a Start9 server and run it on there. But this is something a lot of people have experienced over the last year when they try to spin up a new node and do that initial syncing process that we were talking about. It stalls out in 2023 and 2024 when these spam attacks happen. And that's because of the UTXO set bloat that happened then. And again, it wasn't because people were using Bitcoin as money. It was because of shitcoins. It was mostly because of shitcoins on Bitcoin. So there are people in the community who are actively Bitcoiners, quote unquote Bitcoiners, who are actively scamming newcomers to the space, trying to get them into shitcoins on Bitcoin just so they could take their money. And in the process, it's like peeing in the pool or leaving your needles all over the park, destroying the commons in the process. And so it's become much more difficult to run a node as a result of this. So basically, the UTXO set, which cannot be pruned, it needs to be held by every node runner, it bloated from 4 gigabytes to 12 gigabytes. So all of a sudden, if you're running a Raspberry Pi and it's 4 gigabytes, you can't use it anymore. You need to get some external drive for it, and then it's slower to do the initial sync, the initial block download, et cetera. And so this is a real problem. And this is one way to attack Bitcoin, to make it more difficult to run a node, because it's the node runners like you and me who basically secure the network and ensure that the 21 million cap is enforced. So unlike gold, which has these sort of atomic properties that make it what it is, Bitcoin is enforced by Bitcoiners running nodes. That's how Bitcoin works. And the miners are just employees, the exchanges, they just will trade your Bitcoin for fiat. But it's node runners like you and me who own Bitcoin and run nodes. We are the network and we are the immune system of Bitcoin. And so if you want to hurt Bitcoin, you hurt the node runners, you blow out the UTXO set. So I'm going to come back to the compromise piece. This is all a lead up to that. So we basically had 8 gigabytes of UTXO set bloat. And again, this isn't a question of memory or storage or anything. It just means it can take a lot longer to spin up a node. And in the modern world, when you download a new app on your phone, you know, people's patience is very, very short. If that thing doesn't install and download in like 5 seconds, you've already probably clicked away. And so running a node, it's already a pain now. It's become more expensive thanks to Bitcoin Core. You know, it might cost you $800 or $1,000. And then you have to plug it in. And, you know, not everyone lives in the Presidio or Midtown Manhattan like Bitcoin Core devs and has high-speed internet and a $3,000 computer, et cetera. So there are people on my channel in the comment section, you know, take them 30 days to sync a node. And it syncs really well. And then in 2023 and 2024, it completely crawls to a halt. And so it's a very subtle attack on Bitcoin that a lot of people don't understand. So, and this whole thing goes against basically Bitcoin Core sat on their hands. They didn't do anything while this thing was bloating from 4 gigabytes to 12 gigabytes. And the whole point of Bitcoin Core is to make it easy to run a node and to help Bitcoiners run a node. That is what the project is. Luke Dasher, who's really the OG Bitcoin dev, who's been around since I believe 2011, and he's an interesting person too, because he's seen it all since 2011, and he has this vast memory and context for how things work. So he saw the spam attack for what it was, because he had been in Bitcoin for over 10 years at that point, over a decade. And he put in a pull request, in other words, a request to change the software to stop this from happening, because it's just a complete disaster for node runners. Bitcoin Core turned it down. They said, we're not going to do anything about it. We're not going to merge this PR. We're not going to come up with a new PR of our own. We're just not going to do anything. So again, that's really weird when you have 10 years and you saw the thing I just read from Greg Maxwell saying that this is antisocial, this is bad for the blockchain, this is a huge problem. All of a sudden, it's not a problem in 2023 and 2024. So that could be attributed to laziness or just some sort of ignorance of how Bitcoin arbitrary data has always been treated. But then the real mask off moment came in about a year ago in 2025. And there was this very strong push from Bitcoin Core to blow open Hopperturn. So we talked about how it started off at 40 bytes and then 80 bytes. It's a little bit like the income tax. You know, it starts off at 1% and affects just the super wealthy in 1913. And now, of course, no one's paying 1%, and it affects everyone up and down the tax bracket chain. So what happened is basically they allowed the UTXO set to bloat. They did not let Luke, they didn't merge his fix, which was basically a filter that would have prevented all of this from happening. And the reason A Chow is one of the maintainers, gave for not merging it, saying it was just too controversial. So fast forward to 2025, they decide to blow open another big hole that you can put spam in, which is Hopperturn. So it had been at 40 bytes, raised to 80 bytes, and they decided to just blow it open all the way to 100,000 bytes. So they basically got rid of the cap. They did what's called uncapping data carrier size. And so that 100,000 byte limit, so 1,250 times bigger than 80 bytes, that limit was basically being enforced by other filters in Bitcoin. And what was the reason they gave for it? They gave a number of reasons. And I watched your interview with Chris Guido, which I'd encourage everyone to watch. It's a great, great interview. And he goes through some of the other reasons they gave in terms of mempool fee estimation and block propagation. But the big smoking gun, in my opinion, and I imagine Chris would agree with this, is that the justification they gave in 2025 for blowing open Hopperturn was that this would bloat the UTXO set. And this was done to accommodate a shitcoin, Bitcoin affinity scam startup called Citria. I like to call Shitria. And they told one of the Bitcoin Core devs named Antoine Poinceau that they were going to, as part of their effort to turn Bitcoin into Ethereum, to give people the ability to scam on Bitcoin, as people did on Ethereum, they needed to do this sort of watchtower justice transaction where if something went wrong, they would post a small amount of data onto the chain. And they needed to post, I believe it was 144 bytes. And they wanted to put an Hopperturn, but Hopperturn was only 80 bytes. So they wanted to put the extra 64 bytes in the UTXO set in what's called fake pub keys. And so Antoine first of all, it's very strange that you have Bitcoin Core devs talking to a shitcoin company that basically wants to turn Bitcoin into Ethereum. That's not who I want looking after my node software. They're having these social relationships and they're all hanging out in wherever it is in the Presidio or in Midtown Manhattan. And that's the other problem, these sort of social cliques. So basically, they did that, and this was given as one of the reasons for blowing open Hopperturn, because the main stated reason was we don't want to contribute to UTXO set bloat, and Shitria wants to put 64 bytes, which was never going to happen anyway, it could happen like once every 5 years. Not that Shitria is going to be around in 5 years from now, I can guarantee you that. So they didn't care about 8 gigabytes of UTXO set bloat, but they were willing to blow a giant hole into Bitcoin for 64 bytes. That would probably never happen. This is the Fauci moment where basically there's this huge contradiction, masks don't work, but you have to wear masks now. This is the same thing Bitcoin Core was saying throughout 2025. Filters don't work, filters don't do anything. Oh, but by the way, we need to blow open this filter for Citria, or they're gonna bloat the UTXO set. And we really all of a sudden care about the UTXO set. We care about 64 bytes of bloat when we didn't care about 8 gigabytes and refused to do anything. Now, remember I said A. Chow refused to blow that open, refused Luke's PR to fix inscriptions in 2023 because A. Chow said it was too controversial. So what happens in 2025? Bitcoin Core is willing to blast through this highly, highly contentious change. There's a lot of funny business involved. They were locking and unlocking the repo. They were banning people. They were having private conversations. And basically, this was sort of presented to the world as a fait accompli, that this thing was done and we're going to blow open Hopperturn. And what happened last year as a result of this, 20% of the network left Bitcoin Core and started running much better software, which is Bitcoin Knots. And so we talked about how you might know Fauci's compromised if you don't have that if the information hasn't come out somehow that he was funding labs in Wuhan. Here's this thing where all of a sudden they start worrying about UTXO set bloat when they've been laying down on the job for 3 years. All of a sudden it becomes so, so important. And so I would say this is a moment, this is a little bit like one of the COVIDian moments where we knew Bitcoin Core was lying, just like we knew Fauci was lying. And Bitcoin Core knew that we knew they were lying, and they didn't care. Because like Fauci, they're in a position of power, and it's just like, F you, we're going to push this through. Oh yeah, we don't do contentious updates when they can help to stop the spam problem. But when it's going to increase more spam on the blockchain, because obviously 100,000 bytes is a lot more than 80 bytes, when 20% of the network leaves, highly, highly contentious, we're still going to push it through. So I think that's really the mask off moment. And their technical justifications were so weak. And then their whole response to community pushback was, oh, the plebs, you know, you guys aren't coders, you guys are idiots. It was just like COVID again. You need to trust the experts. And if you don't actually know how to code in C++, you can't even have a conversation about it. This was their point of view. Whereas like it was very clear with COVID, you didn't have to be a virologist to understand what was going on. You didn't have to understand. You could basically see the changing narratives, the gaslighting, the contradictions, just the absurdity of it all. And something similar has happened in Bitcoin.
All makes a lot of sense. So for anyone who isn't familiar, Knots is, you can think of it, it's an alternative that you can run on your node, and it adheres more to the to legacy Bitcoin Core pre some of these changes you're describing.
Yeah. I would actually add to that it's actually a much more configurable software as well, which is okay. nice from sort of a freedom perspective. So it has more knobs and dials than Bitcoin Core. So you can actually run a Bitcoin Knots node and you can increase the spam if you want to. It's not paternalistic like Bitcoin Core. It actually lets you set more things. It'd be more flexible. Though you are correct, the people who run it, they're not running it because they want to create more spam. We got Bitcoin Core to do that for us.
So full disclosure, I do run Knots. The concerns I have with it are, first of all, I think one big one isn't necessarily the software itself. It's not a consensus change. It's a relay policy thing. It's what is your node actually, what transactions is it willing to relay on to others on the network?
Yeah.
To what extent do you find it viable that Knots reaches enough adoption that it's actually useful and not just a philosophical stance that you're taking, which candidly is more or less why I run Knots? And then I think the second big concern is the lack of, not that obviously Core has its problems from a development perspective, but you've got more or less Luke is kind of the guy with Knots and relatively fewer eyeballs on Knots in addition to a lower number of developers. How do you address both the adoption concern and maybe like the technical concern that people might have with something like Knots?
Yeah, they're both good questions. So we can start by, for people who don't know, Bitcoin Knots is actually a fork or a mod of Bitcoin Core. And that's not like a soft fork or a hard fork. It basically means like a copy paste. Then you make some changes, as you said, to the memfo filters, which affect what gets relayed from node to node. Luke does have some discretion what he ports over as well, but they're basically consensus compatible. So it's the same Bitcoin. They enforce the same basic rules in terms of what can get end up in a block. And so you have a situation where tradition for the last decade, you had 99% of node runners running Bitcoin Core. And as I said, this has now shifted. So it's more 20% running Knots and 80% running Core. So the first sort of pushback I would make is that Bitcoin Core, the way it functions, you have many, many contributors. It's an open source project. There are probably 200, 300 people who contribute, who have contributed, you know, it might just be one line of code. But then you have this really core group of maintainers who have write access to the repo and are seem to be friends and in the same social cliques, et cetera. And so even though you have five, maybe you have six maintainers now, I'm trying to remember the exact number, there's a lot of groupthink going on, as we do know. and it kind of functions. They all protect each other. It's like this little inner cabal. So Bitcoin Core is fairly centralized. Bitcoin Knots is even more centralized because you only have one maintainer. But it's already an improvement for the network to have two separate implementations running because you have one sort of centralized implementation, and then you have one really centralized implementation. But Luke is a real contrarian, kind of someone who always speaks his mind, and you know, whether no matter the social cost. And so just having two different implementations that still have the same consensus rules, I think there is an improvement in terms of robustness and anti-fragility there. So if there is a bug that takes down all the Bitcoin Core nodes, now we have at least 20% are running Knots. So that does make the network more more resilient. And then the great irony is the biggest bug that we've seen in the past 12 months, apart from the sort of malicious stuff that perhaps Bitcoin Core has done, the biggest bug we've seen shipped with this very controversial version of Bitcoin Core version 30. And it basically, after all this talk, like Luke doesn't know what he's doing, and you know, there's just one maintainer, we can't trust him. After all of this, they weren't careful enough to with Bitcoin Core 30. It basically shipped with a bug that they were basically changing wallet types, the wallet that comes with the node. And as part of this migration, you had to migrate from the old wallet to the new wallet. There was a wallet migration bug, and someone was not paying attention, and Bitcoin Core made the decision to delete. If there was a problem with the migration, Bitcoin Core would delete the old wallet rather than just saving it just to be safe. So this is a major bug. I've talked to Bitcoiners who lost money. Core has clearly shown malicious sort of compromised behavior, but they're also shipping buggy code, very embarrassing. And so there seems to be something broken with their process as well, their sort of quality assurance. And this was a bug that Luke did not, because he's very careful when he adds new features or does this stuff. So this did not affect Bitcoin Knots user. So that's the first thing I would say. Using the great irony, if you use a Bitcoin Core this year, you might have had your wallet deleted, but the bug was not present in Bitcoin Knots. Nevertheless, you are right. It's not good to have one guy in charge of something. And this is the very sad state we're in Bitcoin, where we have a compromised Bitcoin Core. And then we have this OG who, for people who don't know who Luke Dasher is, he has literally saved Bitcoin two, arguably three different times. One of the times very early, I believe like 2013, there was this chain split, and he was the guy who came up with the way of basically healing it. He literally saved Bitcoin. He also saved it again with the UASF in 2017. And we'd have big blocks. We'd basically look like Bcash or BSV if it weren't for Luke Dasher. And actually Bitcoin Mechanic was involved in that UASF as well. And so if you had to pick someone, Luke is a maverick. He's a contrarian. He's a difficult figure. And he's also a CS genius. He's an absolute genius. So it's not ideal to have one person. On the other hand, we are a decentralized project. No one controls Bitcoin. And we're in a really bad place where the reference implementation went wrong. And so once again, a lot is hanging on poor Luke's shoulders. And he's as I understand it, I don't want to attribute something to him that he's not doing. As I understand it, he spends, because Ocean is pretty much built out now, they're a mining pool company. He spends almost all of his time working on Bitcoin Knots. And he's extremely careful. He also he still contributes to Bitcoin Core in terms of reporting bugs to them when he finds it. I mean, one way of looking at it is you have Bitcoin Core looking at all the code, and then they create their version, and then Luke comes in and looks at it and decides if there's a wallet deletion bug, he probably is not going to move that over. And so Luke in some sense is almost like a sixth or seventh maintainer who looks at Bitcoin Core, and then he doesn't change that much. It's mostly the same software. It's probably 99% the same software. But we are in the weird situation where Luke has saved Bitcoin at least twice before. And he's now at the center of the two most important things happening in Bitcoin right now, the two essential things, which is diversifying ourselves away from having just one reference implementation with Bitcoin Core. So it's very good. And now that 20% of the network is running Knots, you know, that must be a huge weight on Luke's shoulders to have to, you know, the stakes are so much higher, and he takes great pride in it. The thing I've noticed on Twitter as well is that he actually talks to node runners. He talks to the plebs. He's actually actively talking to plebs, asking them to report bugs, et cetera, talking about their experience. Like, he takes it very seriously. He's a very serious guy, and he doesn't suffer fools idly. And then on the Bitcoin Core side, we have a lot of very disinterested people who don't really want to hear. They don't want to be bothered. They're software developers who don't want to hear from their users. And so we've had situations. I can't remember if Chris Guida talked about it on your show, but he used to work for Start9. He helped people spin up hundreds, if not thousands, of nodes. And so when Bitcoin Core was talking about node syncing speeds, et cetera, Chris offered his input. They didn't want to talk to him. And then when Bitcoin Core is rolling out Bitcoin Core version 30, one of their justifications was mining pool centralization. So Bob Burnett, who runs Barefoot Mining, and is a really kind of senior executive guy. He was the chief technical officer at Gateway. So he's a real tech guy. He's not like an English major like me. He went to Bitcoin Core to offer his input, and they didn't want to talk to him either. So this is another reason we know they're compromised, because their justifications for doing what they do, they don't actually want to talk to real users. And so this is one thing that I really like about Bitcoin Knots. The good news though about Bitcoin Knots as well is, as the adoption rises, the funding is now rising for it. And so there are things happening. It looks like some more devs are going to be going over there. There are already people, I believe, helping Luke part-time. But this is like anything else. This is like saying, you know, who's going to run Bitcoin Core in 2011, or how are we going to pay these people? And if there's demand for a software product, the funding comes. And a lot of people have seen how important it is now to have different clients to run. There's a third node implementation project that's being launched by Jimmy Song and Samson Mao called Production Ready. And so I think this will be good if they're able to, these things take time, but we'll move to the point where maybe there are three implementations. I think Bitcoin Core has a real branding and people problem, so maybe they just disappear, or they have to change their name or something.
My thought is, I would love to reach a stage where there's no longer really a reference implementation, that the code base is forked as it was with Knots. Probably some derivative of the main code base will be what Production Ready is with, again, to what Knots has done. Minor adjustments, maybe more conservative than Core's been. Maybe it's not quite as dogmatic as what Knots is. But at least when someone is spinning up a new node, they actually have to pause and assess, what is it that I want to run? Where do my values lie? Because today, my concern with Knots is, because it's only 20%, if I'm just a random guy off the street, found Bitcoin, heard I should run a node, decided to spin one up, I'm going to say, okay, well, what should I run? Probably the latest version of the thing that the most people run.
Yeah.
Right. And then people are going to by default opt into that. And I'm not, it's not even like a philosophical claim that you should or shouldn't. It's more just to make people step back for a moment and say, okay, I'm going to do this thing. What's the thing that how should I approach this? And have to go do a little bit of research, which maybe creates a bit of friction in getting people to run nodes, but at least they're more mindful about, why am I here for Bitcoin? Am I here because I want BRC20 tokens? Am I here for ordinals? Am I here for sound money? And they can make that judgment themselves.
I think it's a situation that's going to heal itself too, because I heard similar, this is good pushback, but I heard similar pushback when Bitcoin Knots was at 1% of the network last May. And people were mocking us and saying, who's going to run this? It's so small, et cetera. And now we're at 20% and we're still growing. And our soft fork client, which we could talk about later, is growing as well. And so I think people, first of all, most Bitcoiners don't run nodes. I didn't run a node for a couple of years. And I think the landscape is rapidly changing. The new adoption in Bitcoin nodes is all people running Bitcoin Knots, because no one in the space is advocating, or very few people. I know you guys do, but very few people are advocating for running a Bitcoin node. And even Bitcoin Core devs, they don't seem to care about it. And there's been some evidence. Jeremy Rubin went on a podcast and basically said that Bitcoin Core devs, none of them run nodes, or most of them don't run nodes.
That's wild.
The point I was getting to is that Bitcoin Knots could be at 50% very soon. And when BIP 110 wins, So we'll go into that later maybe, but Bitcoin Core isn't even prepared for BIP 110. So I think the landscape will be quite different. It's almost like saying, you know, if people are going to come to get a COVID shot, are they going to get the Pfizer, or, you know, are they going to know that that one was slightly worse because it had, you know, turbo cancer in it than the Moderna one? Well, these things sort of solve themselves, because when people start comparing notes and, you know, their uncle died because they got the Pfizer vax, they're not going to, we don't have to worry about people, you know, word will spread. And the same is true with Core. You know, the guys who had their wallets deleted by Core are not going to, you know, they'll be letting people know, don't run Core.
Yeah, that's probably too true. And honestly, the attention that this battle has gained, It's I think going to bring more people online with nodes, which I think is fantastic.
It's had a real silver lining that way. I agree.
Yeah, because people realize, oh, the network is only as resilient as its user base. Like the network is, to your point, the network is the people.
It is the but people.
My belief of Bitcoin is that you can buy as much Bitcoin as you want, and you can even take it into self-custody, and you are not a participant in the network unless you are also running a node. You're still somewhat passively.
Well, you don't even know that you have it if you're not running a node. You may think you have it in self custody, but your hardware wallet maker or the software associated with may just be spoofing it. And how do you even, you can't even send it without a node. Like you have to rely on someone else's node. So if you ever want to spend it or move it around, you're really a second class citizen, as you know, if you don't run a node, because you can't verify that it's real Bitcoin. You're not really a participant in the network, enforcing the rules. And if we ever run into a bad situation, like who knows what's going to happen in 2028 in the US or wherever people are, maybe you won't be able to access public nodes, or it may become difficult. And then that's the other thing too, if you don't want to leak privacy, if you use someone else's node, they're noticing all your transactions, and you know, we really don't want that. So they're good selfish, self-interested reasons to run a Bitcoin node. And we want to, I was sort of guilty of this in my early videos, kind of attributing, and I think a lot of people make this mistake when they're new to Bitcoin, attributing to Bitcoin these magic qualities, like, you know, Satoshi created this perfect software that magically keeps everything at 21 million. And, you know, Satoshi gave us a great gift, but this is not how Bitcoin works. Bitcoin is whatever Bitcoiners want it to be. And so this is one of the concerns with Chytria, that they want to, you know, if Bitcoiners decide to turn Bitcoin into Ethereum, there's nothing that can stop that from happening. We can move to proof of stake just like Ethereum. And it's the node runners that decide these things. And so if you have any significant portion of your net worth in Bitcoin, Bitcoin is always under attack, and we need good Bitcoiners to run nodes, enforce the rules, fight spam, because Bitcoin doesn't defend itself. It's not magic software. There's shit coins like Bcash and BSV that are very, very similar software because they're forks of Bitcoin, and they're absolutely terrible because the culture is different and it's used for different things. So there's nothing magical about software. Just Bitcoiners are special people. And they're also, when you have all your money in Bitcoin, like I do, you really take these things seriously. And if you're a Bitcoin Core dev who just graduated from college and you don't have any Bitcoin and you don't run a node, you know, that's pretty sad. You kind of be forgiven. You can understand why those people aren't terrified of what's been happening to Bitcoin.
Let's touch on BIP 110 briefly here. Why don't you give just the quick overview of what it is? And then I think more importantly, what do you think the likelihood of it activating is? And if it doesn't, what's the fallout?
So, let me give the context for that. So we basically have had this escalation in fighting spam because, as I said, unlike in 2014, when we had the help of Bitcoin Core, we basically have a hostile Bitcoin Core implementation that just doesn't even want to talk about these things and has blocked everyone. And so the way we've escalated is we first kind of fought the social media battle with Bitcoin Core and its supporters, saying, please don't do this. Please don't ship Bitcoin Core 30 because it has all these problems. And they went ahead and did it anyway. And then they blocked everyone. And just basically, it was just like Fauci, like, well, you know, you're going to take the shot whether you want it or not, you know, or if you want to work or get an airplane or go to a restaurant. And so what we did is, you know, many of us just deserted, dumped Bitcoin Core, started running Bitcoin Knots. and running better filters. So that's the first place that we fought the battle, was that the level of mempool filters. And to be very clear, filters are not censorship. They've been around. Filters were invented by Satoshi Nakamoto and have been around since 2019. And so that's the other thing. The other reason you know Bitcoin Core is compromised, all this gaslighting that filters is censorship, absolute nonsense. It's no more censorship than Gmail, for example, saying you can't upload an attachment more than 25 megabytes. That's not Google censoring you. That's just Google telling you, if you want to send a giant file, use Google Drive or Google Storage or something. Don't use email for it. And likewise with mempool filters. So we had this escalation at the social layer and then sort of at the mempool layer. And yet, but the problem we have now is approximately 80% of the network is running Bitcoin Core version 30 or version 31, or one of these versions that has a large op return. And this is very dangerous for the Bitcoin network because there's this giant spot there now for arbitrary data, for non-monetary data. And you can imagine Bitcoin Mechanic likes using this analogy, like who would just like spin up a server and open it up to the internet and let people fill it with whatever they want. You know, immediately if you did something like that, it'd be filled with just, you know, the stuff you see on 4chan or whatever, just be filled with, or much, much worse stuff. And the one thing we've focused on a little bit on my side is child sexual abuse material and the risks of this hitting Bitcoin. And when you create a large space for it, it becomes a much bigger risk. And there have been forks of Bitcoin like BSV that have been totally destroyed by people posting this horrific, horrific material. And that the problem with CSAM, child sexual abuse material on Bitcoin, is Bitcoin has an immutable blockchain. And so you can't really, if someone discovers it's there, there's no way to delete it. And so basically the network has been exposed since October 10th, since this thing shipped. And there's been, you know, as there was adoption and people rolling over from Bitcoin Core version 29 to 30, you basically have this huge new attack surface for Bitcoin. It's a CSAM attack surface. But there's other things people can put there. You can just, you know, there are many different cultures in the world, many different, you know, types of people. And you could imagine, you know, putting something there that would upset the Chinese government, or that would upset Muslims or Christians or whoever. Like this is not. I basically did not get in the game of Bitcoin to host whatever data people want me to put on my node, and it's not something I'm willing to fight for. It's not something that's important, and I sure as hell don't want anything like CSAM on my computer. So this is the real threat, and this is the reason that we've moved. Because Bitcoin Core refused to reverse course and back down, all they really need to do, they could do it today. They can make this problem go away today. Just revert data carrier size, revert op return from 100,000 back down to 80. You want to take the wind out of our sails? Just do that. You know, then what are we going to? There's still the inscriptions problem. There's still the problem that we don't trust Bitcoin Core. But that would be a great gesture. And that's the bizarre thing about Bitcoin Core. They're willing to fragment the network. They're willing to cause a contentious chain split just because they're so stubborn. They pushed through this thing that was unpopular. It's become much less popular since then, and they're unwilling to revert the changes. So that's what makes people think maybe there's an attack vector here that was planned. Basically, if a CSAM thing ended up in a Bitcoin op return, you have about 10 to 30 minutes to try to reorg it out by mining on a different block, mining on the block before, and sort of make sure that block doesn't end up as part of the blockchain. It's very, very difficult to do. Once it's in the blockchain, it's there. It's basically there forever unless you do a manual intervention and basically hard code that block. So the problem is, if there's CSAM in the blockchain, imagine a node runner, you know, 10 years from now, or just someone today, do you want to spin up a new node and in the process you have to download child sexual abuse material on your computer? It's like a non-starter. It's absolute non-starter. It's not the fact that it's illegal. It's the fact that it's inhuman and disgusting. And, you know, people who have kids and people who don't have kids, everyone's against that. And so what we've moved to do is to do BIP 110, which aims to do many different things. It's not just a CSAM thing, but I thought I would bring that up because that's an important thing that we need to make sure that doesn't happen. And we've been very lucky that it hasn't happened since October 10th. But what Bitcoin Core, what BIP 110 is, it's a temporary soft fork. So it's a temporary change in the rules that aims to basically roll things back and revert the changes that Bitcoin Core has made over the past 2 or 3 years, and basically rejecting their idea that Bitcoin is a file storage service that can just be used for anything. So it asserts that Bitcoin is money. It reverts op return back from 100,000 down to 80 bytes at the consensus level. And so you won't be able to include large nasty things in op returns after this. And it also fixes the inscriptions bug, which Bitcoin Core, in spite of all their concern about UTXO set below, they somehow, you know, just let this happen. So it fixes that and closes that attack vector, and basically reverts a lot of these bad changes that Core has made. The problem we have is the Bitcoin Core reference implementation for Node software pushed through something unilaterally. And so BitBoin 10 and Bitcoin Knots people's messages, you cannot do that as devs. You're just like five young people. You cannot do this to Bitcoin. This is not how Bitcoin works. Bitcoin is decentralized. You need to get Node Runner's permission. And so we're going to push back against you. And we tried to do it nicely. We tried to do it with mempool filters. We tried to do it with Bitcoin Knots, et cetera. But you've now exposed the network to really horrible things, and done it basically to accommodate these crypto VCs and companies like Chytria. So it's disgusting what's happening. And it may just be financial interests, or it may be an actual attack on Bitcoin in an effort to discourage node runners. So BIP 110 is a temporary soft fork.
Why temporary? Real quick, why temporary? Or maybe you'll get to that.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So a soft fork is, let's first talk about what a fork is. So a fork is just a change in the rules. And so BIP 110 is a change in the software rules, or the consensus rules. BIP 110 is actually very simple. It just basically reverts op return back, fixes the inscriptions hack, and closes a couple other attack surfaces that Luke is aware of. This is an interesting insight. He's aware of these things. They're in the BIP, and they haven't been exploited yet. So we're trying to be proactive about these things as well. And we're trying to do it in a way where we don't let the spammers and scammers know about these attack surfaces. So it's a very delicate thing we're trying to do. You have a fork, which is a change in the consensus rules, where basically people start running different software on their nodes. And a soft fork narrows the rules. So it creates a subset of the existing rules, whereas a hard fork widens the rules. People may have heard of Bcash and Roger Ver and that whole thing. That was a hard fork because Ver, he widened the rules. The consensus rule was blocks can only be 1 megabyte or less. And so let's say you wanted to do a soft fork with that and narrow the rules. You could lower the max block size to 0.8 megabytes, for example, instead of 1 megabyte. That would be a soft fork because you're narrowing the rules, and the existing nodes would still accept that because the rule is the block has to be 1 megabytes or less, and 0.8 megabytes is less. And so old nodes will still find those blocks valid. Hard forks are more difficult to do because you need to get everyone to upgrade their clients. And so what Roger Ver did is he changed the block size from 1 megabytes to, I can never remember if it's 4 megabytes. I think it's maybe 8 megabytes. That's a hard fork. That's widening the rules. And so the reason we're doing this as a soft fork, say we lower op return from 100,000 down to 80 bytes, and then there's some, or we make some other change. And then there's people realize, oh, we actually needed 160 byte op returns. If you do a soft fork to narrow the rules, and then you want to go back to where the rules were before, and you want to take it back up from 80 bytes to 160 bytes for data carrier size, that would be a hard fork because you'd be widening the rules again. And the rule in Bitcoin is really just never do a hard fork. There's some edge cases in a real emergency. We could do a hard fork for various things. So that's one reason it's temporary. It's basically a cooling off period. You can imagine that in the lifespan of these crypto scam startups, a whole year of not being able to do their spams and scams is devastating to them. And it will lead to less funding of these scammy companies. So put the ones, you know, they're basically going to be handcuffed. And if they try to change and do other things, we can hit them with our mempool filters afterwards. So that's one reason it's temporary. It's temporary just to be very conservative, to make sure we don't break anything. And again, it's a very conservative soft fork. It doesn't add any new functionality. It doesn't cause, this is something we didn't really talk about, that the last soft fork that was really driven by Bitcoin Core and arranged by Bitcoin Core with the miners turned out to be, was Taproot. And that's really the source of a lot of the Bitcoin spam. just because of the way they did it. And so we're doing something much more conservative than that, that this soft fork will basically expire after 12 months. And it gives the community time to figure out a real solution to these problems and to sort of optimize like how big op return should be. There's another thing it does is it temporarily takes away what are called upgrade hooks, which are needed for future versions of SegWit and Taproot and other updates. And so you need upgrade hooks, and not taking them away would have made this soft fork much more difficult and the code more difficult. So we basically take it away for 12 months. And it's actually not measured in time. It's measured in blocks or block height. But this is a soft fork that was developed by a NIM named Dathan Ohm. And so this is, I think he tried to construct it in the most conservative way possible, where it doesn't break any of the monetary use cases of Bitcoin. But it closes the attack surfaces, especially the CSAM thing is just awful and huge. It buys us some time. And it also just demonstrates community opposition to these people. And it pushes back on Bitcoin Core and says, look, you can't unilaterally change things. The network will fight you on this. You said you don't push through consensus changes. You did it anyway. Well, look, this is what happens. You refuse to back down and move it back down from 100,000 to 80 bytes. Well, we're going to soft fork you out. And no one wants what you did, except the people who are benefiting from the spam. So those are the basic reasons. It's a temporary soft fork. We've tried to do it in the most conservative way, and it doesn't require a hard fork to undo.
So last question on all of this subject, because I want to do a sort of a lightning round with you on just a couple of other unrelated things. If BIP 110 doesn't activate, if Knots doesn't gain...
Oh, I should... I didn't answer the second part of your question. I'll answer that really quickly because it's going to activate. It is set up. We are going to activate it. It is going to happen, BIP 110. And this is one of the reasons I'm doing the podcast circuit to tell people about this so that they're prepared. And especially the miners need to be prepared. So there are two ways that it activates. This soft fork can be activated any day, any two-week period by the miners, these large mining pools, if they want to. So we're sort of giving them this as a courtesy. And then if they don't go ahead and do the right thing and activate it, because maybe they just like mining spam, and they make a little bit of extra money from it, which itself is kind of an illusion because of the difficulty adjustment. That's its own rabbit hole. But if the miners don't go ahead and do it, first, it's important to note that the miners, the large mining pools, they're employees of the network. They basically need to do what the node runners like you and me tell them to do. So we're giving them a chance to make this a very smooth transition. They can activate it as what's called an MASF, a miner activated soft fork. If they do not activate it, we are going to be activating it. There are a couple of stages, but I think something like August 7th is the big date. You can go to bip110.org if you want to read about this. But on August 7th, this thing will activate as a user activated soft fork. And the first step we're going to do is we will basically... malicious miners who don't seem to have a problem with spam or CSAM and want to keep producing these blocks, we're going to be throwing their blocks in the garbage starting August 7th. And the problem with throwing someone's blocks in the garbage is they spend $300,000 on electricity for the block, and then they don't get paid for it. And so this is basically what happened in 2017. Luke Dasher was one of the leaders. Bitcoin Mechanic was one of the leaders as well. They were doing a very similar thing called BIP 148, which is UASF. And this is what got SegWit activated. And so this thing, we have people like Luke and Mechanic who have done this rodeo before. They're not new to it. Luke is the foremost expert in the world on soft forks and consensus changes. I can guarantee you that. He's a game theory master. And they've already done one successful soft fork, led it in 2017. And they were able to do it with just 500 nodes out of 100,000 nodes. And right now we're at something like 10 or 11,000 nodes. So we're way ahead of where they were in 2017. So this thing will activate because the node runners will activate it. And it's basically no one is against it. There are a lot of apathetic people who don't really care one way or the other. And then there's a very, very small group who likes the status quo of Bitcoin Core being in charge and being able to put spam on the blockchain. The game theory around soft forks is very, very interesting. And it turns out in Bitcoin, you can have a small, intolerant minority like us. So we're only 11, 12% of the network. I think that's enough to push through a change like this. It's a conservative change. It's a narrowing of the rules. And there's an excellent article your viewers can check out called I believe it was published in Bitcoin Magazine in 2017. It's called UASF, User Activated Soft Forks, and the Intolerant Minority. And it basically demonstrates that doing soft forks like this is much easier than people think. And the only way to stop something like this is to do what's called a URSF, a user resisted soft fork, which would be very awkward for the other side to do because they would basically be saying, we want CSAM and spam on our blockchain. So it's kind of an untenable position. It's unclear like who would support something like that. And especially if miners tried to do it, you can imagine large regulated miners saying, we want child sexual abuse material on our side. Like it seems unlikely that they would want something like that. And most of the mining pools just want to go along to get along. So this thing is going to activate, and I think it's going to win. It's going to be successful because there's no one, most Bitcoin plebs like it. Like you can go in your comment section if this is posted on YouTube when we're done, read what the plebs have to say. Go to the comment section of any Bitcoin Mechanic video or Bitcoin University, which is where I post my videos. Look at the comment section, see all these Bitcoin plebs who are running Bitcoin knots and also running BIP110 and signaling for this. And these are people who are committed, seem to be mostly committed family men, and they have a surprising amount of Bitcoin. I talked to many of these people, and they're warriors. And you'd be surprised how many people have a few hundred Bitcoin or even a few thousand Bitcoin on our side. They're renting hash, they're mining for it. And so we have an army, basically, a BIP110 army. And there's no one to oppose us on the other side because we're not trying to hurt Bitcoin. We're just trying to close attack surfaces. The people on the other side, especially the Bitcoin core devs, they're fairly weak, passive, people pleaser types, you know, kind of corporate types who just want to get paid a lot of money to do software. They're not like the cypherpunk army that we've assembled on our side.
Okay, interesting. So August, we'll have to stay tuned for that. Okay, I want to hit a few additional topics. I don't know that you've covered all. You've probably covered all of these at some point in time, but these are just all topics that I hear about all the just every day. There's something, the Clarity Act. There's supposed to be all sorts of.
I love government names. Patriot Act, the Clarity Act.
Yeah, there's always
clarity. The U.S. government's always so honest with us. They always give us clarity. That's great.
The marketing is always impressive when it comes from Congress. But I'm curious if you have any initial thoughts on the Clarity Act. What the likelihood of that passing is? Is it good, bad?
I haven't dug that deeply in it because I basically don't care. I don't need permission from the U.S. government to run a node and use Bitcoin. There's some interesting parts in there that, having protection for devs from the U.S. government, there's some good self-custody protections, but they're not really protections because at least the versions that I've seen, it's basically like, Americans have the right to run a Bitcoin node. It's like, thank you. Yes, I know that.
I knew that.
Yeah. I had you don't give me that right. I have that right. And basically, the Clarity Act gives you the right to self-custody unless you're, dealing with sanctioned transactions or doing something the government doesn't like. So it's like any law. And that's why I haven't been following it too closely. Obviously, there's a civil war going on, so there's been bigger things. But the U.S. government runs on the U.S. dollar. The U.S. government and the central bankers are our enemies, and they can pass whatever they want. But we all know how this is going to end. And laws can be changed. Executive orders can be reversed. And we need to win using cypherpunk principles. It's fine if people want to play the political game. I'm fairly cynical, especially seeing what's happened over the last 18 months. These systems are very robust. Even you could put something like someone like Bobby Kennedy in there who was very good on the COVID and the vaccine stuff. And it appears to me, at least, I haven't been following it very closely, but he's been a good guy who obviously really believes these things. He's been sort of shut down and handcuffed, and he seems to have a lot of free time on his hand to go on podcasts, which is surprising that he's in government now. I think he has good intentions. So it's the same thing. You send someone in there to fix big pharma, and they either get co-opted, or if they're a good guy like RFK Jr., they get their hands tied. So I don't expect many. I'm not waiting for the government to help me.
Okay. I tend to agree with that. I could echo everything you just said. How about Michael Saylor? He had recently sold a little bit of Bitcoin. And I think you've been critical at times on and off of different people, certainly in the treasury company space. What's your general take on what's happening there?
I've sort of stayed quiet about it until the last week or so. But Michael Saylor's become a shit coiner. It's shocking to say this is the depressing thing of the last 12 months. People going rogue like Greg Maxwell and Adam Back. And Michael Saylor is actively promoting Ethereum DeFi protocols on his X. And he's doing it because people can lever up their Stretch preferred shares from Strategy, which he's using to buy Bitcoin. But basically he said he would never sell Bitcoin, then he sold it. I don't think that's a huge deal because there is some sort of treasury or cash management there. But I find the more disturbing things to be that he after spending years talking about Bitcoin as being ethical money and Ethereum as being garbage, that he's now actually retweeting Ethereum garbage. And he's also making posts like saying Strategy, his company, turns Bitcoin into money. As if we need Michael Saylor or Strategy. I think Satoshi gave us money in 2009. The other thing I don't like about the Bitcoin treasury companies in general is they're just sort of hype machines. That the only reason to own the shares, the common shares, is because you want to outperform Bitcoin, which is always a fool's errand. This is what people, I was late to Bitcoin. I heard about it in 2011. I didn't get in, really start buying and hodling until 2019. We're all late to Bitcoin. We all wish we had more Bitcoin. There's only one way to catch up, which is like working really hard, producing goods and services that the world wants, getting paid in Bitcoin and stacking it. That's the only way to catch up. Buying Bitcoin treasury company common shares, this does nothing for Bitcoin adoption. And if you think about it, it actually has a very dangerous side effect, which is it centralizes a huge amount of Bitcoin at these large U.S. custodians, like Coinbase Custody and Fidelity, et cetera. So that's where all Strategy's Bitcoin is. It's not like Michael Saylor's keeping it on his seed signer. And the problem with this is these are huge attack vectors, large pools of Bitcoin. This was what happened in 1933 when President Roosevelt stole all Americans' gold. He didn't go door to door. He basically just took it out of the bank vaults. And this is going to happen to the large centralized custodians in the U.S. All that money is going to be hacked or lost or stolen by the deep state or by the federal government or by someone. And so I've been really pushing back and I've been getting a lot of hate for it. I don't think loading up Bitcoin plebs with preferred stock like Stretch and giving them some yield, I don't think that's how newcomers should be onboarded. I don't think they should be encouraged to use DeFi protocols. And stacking sats at Coinbase Custody does nothing for Bitcoin adoption. What does something for Bitcoin adoption is when Bitcoiners live on a Bitcoin standard, earn Bitcoin, spend Bitcoin, run a node, mine with Bitcoin, et cetera. So the whole thing, I find it disgusting. It's exploiting retail investors. 80% of Stretch shareholders are retail investors, and they're being encouraged to use DeFi protocols. So I'm very disappointed in Saylor. He's a brilliant guy. I'm frankly just mystified why he would take a turn like this.
Yeah. Kill your heroes. That's what we say. Okay. Last one. What's that?
Kill them metaphorically, of course.
Metaphorically. Yes. Yes. This is a peaceful show. Last bit. I'm going to call a little bit of an audible here. I would love to hear your thoughts though, on at the time of this recording, this won't air for a couple of weeks, but the price has sort of tanked the last few days, last 4 or 5 days, I guess. And would love to know to what extent, and by the way, I'm asking you now a series of questions I don't care about at all, but I know that people have curiosities about these things.
Yeah, no, it's
Do you have like a thesis on the price action? Like why haven't we hit $500,000, Matthew? What's going on?
Well, one very dark explanation. I mean, there's the obvious explanation, which is the reference implementation went rogue, like we've been talking about. And the network's now exposed to CSAM threats and spam threats and large amounts of arbitrary data. So we have a serious Bitcoin governance problem, and we're about to have a soft fork. So it could be that. There's also the new Fed chair is a little bit more hawkish than maybe people thought. So interest rates aren't falling, et cetera. We're in a bear market. We've been in a bear market that started on October 10th when Bitcoin Core released Bitcoin Core version 30. It might just be a coincidence, but it's quite striking. We were joking about it at the time, and it turns out that was the top, basically that day when this malware was released on the network. But there's the darker explanation, which I'm increasingly contemplating, which is that the BlackRock spot ETF, Bitcoin spot ETF, IBIT, MicroStrategy, holding basically their ways of collecting a lot of Bitcoin at these centralized custodians, as we said. And Michael Saylor's refused to do proof of reserve, so no one really knows. We assume the Bitcoin's there. You know, America's not a total banana republic, at least not yet. But the problem with having these large pools and putting them in the hands of people like Brian Armstrong, who's a shitcoiner and a lackey of the U.S. government, or the hands of Larry Fink, I mean, I don't have to tell people about BlackRock, is that they may be using this Bitcoin that Saylor has so conveniently pooled for them. They may be rehypothecating it. Again, no proof of reserves. And they may be using it to manipulate the market price. And if you had told me that we'd be at wherever we are, 60-something thousand in 2026 after a Bitcoin-friendly president like Trump, or after the Bitcoin spot ETF, or after Saylor buying whatever, $60 billion worth of Bitcoin, there's something wrong. There's something wrong because Bitcoin is very scarce. So I think we have a problem with paper Bitcoin. The best way your viewers can fight this is dump your strategy shares, sell your IBIT, buy real Bitcoin, hold it in self-custody, and please don't leave your Bitcoin on exchanges because it's going to get stolen. And it contributes to these large pools that are used, that may be being used, I should say, to suppress Bitcoin's price. I feel like we're being attacked in Bitcoin from so many different directions at this point. But fortunately, we are pushing back. But I think those are explanations for the fiat price.
Yeah, I would say I've grown increasingly cynical, and I look at Bitcoin-backed loans, treasury companies, Wall Street adoption, and my head just goes to that is their way of accumulating Bitcoin.
Yeah,
other people paying for it, and we're gonna have a lot of
bait and switch. Is what it is. It's just like the shitcoin bait and switch. You know, I love Bitcoin. Buy my preferred stock. And let me interject one thing there because you mentioned Bitcoin loans. I really recommend against people taking Bitcoin loans. I used to advocate for them a little bit about 3 years ago. The problem with Bitcoin loans is you give your Bitcoin to someone else, to the lender, even if it's locked in a 2 of 3 multisig, it's still risky. I think one of the ways that the financial complex will confiscate people's Bitcoin and good Bitcoiners' Bitcoin is that it will engineer a price crash or a flash crash. And to the extent that you have all that Coinbase, the Saylor's accumulated at Coinbase custody to enable them to do this, they'll crash the price. And I would ask people who have loans, I think I asked this in my video this morning, what are you going to do if Bitcoin goes down to $5,000 and just spends 12 hours there, 12 hours, 24 hours, 36 hours at $5,000? Do you have the collateral to top up your Bitcoin loan, or are you going to be liquidated? So I think Bitcoin loans are extremely dangerous. They're a way of people sort of living beyond their means and trying to have their cake and eat it too. There's probably 1% of the population that's financially sophisticated enough and disciplined enough. But even then, you know, if you're doing a Bitcoin loan, do like 5% or 10% of your Bitcoin and expect to have it confiscated in a flash crash, because this is going to happen in the next 5 years. So it's going to be a flash crash and a lot of people are going to lose their Bitcoin.
Bingo. You nailed it. And if anyone listening thinks that Matt sounds too cynical,
I
would argue that if you think he sounds crazy, you're probably not skeptical enough. What you just said, I think, is spot on.
Wall Street pay for 30 years. So Wall Street is just, you know, these are the games they play all the time.
It's a big club and you ain't in it. Okay, so last question for you, Matt. What is an unpopular, I know some of them. Let's maybe we can come up with another one. What is an unpopular opinion that you have? Bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it.
I feel like I've done that a lot.
You kind of told all your
unpopular opinions. I think the big one is that Bitcoin's immune system is not as strong as it should be. And a lot of Bitcoiners talk a really big game and they say, slay your heroes and call out people. And yet they're too scared to call out Adam Back or Michael Saylor. Like, it's nice to say slay your heroes, but I don't see anyone slaying their heroes. And the problem is a lot of people being paid by their heroes or somehow incentivized. You know, they're getting invited to the Saylor yacht parties or whatever. But I think Bitcoin's immune system is less strong than people think. And that's one of the things I'm working on, strengthening it, just telling people about these problems. There's the classic thing with Bitcoin mining that, you know, all the mining rig operators will switch away if a pool gets too big. We just haven't seen that happening. And basically, Bitcoin's only as good as the Bitcoiners who defend it. And I think there's still a large enough number of Bitcoin plebs who are really the heart and soul of the network who have rallied. If I hadn't seen this reaction from Bitcoin plebs, I probably would have gotten out of Bitcoin, just because if the reference implementation or if miners can tell us what to do unilaterally, Bitcoin it's not valuable. It's simply not valuable, and it will get priced in eventually. And I'd like to get out before that happens, because I basically have my life savings in Bitcoin apart from my house. And so that would be my unpopular thing that I would say to all the Bitcoiners who say, you know, slay your heroes and, you know, I'm toxic, you know, be toxic, et cetera. Are you willing to slay Saylor when he starts shitcoining? Like, that shouldn't be that hard. This guy's pushing ERC-20 tokens after talking them down, you know, for years. So that would be the most unpopular thing. I'd like to see more Bitcoiners waking up so we can make this thing work and we can end up separating money from state.
Amen. I couldn't agree with that more. There have been so many quote unquote heroes I've had to just rid myself of.
It's really depressing years. And it's sad. It's sad to see. It breaks my
heart. It is. There's the good news is that there are actually I had Luke DeWolf on the podcast recently, and he wrote an excellent book on defending Bitcoin and what we need to do as plebs to be resilient. Yeah. And so it's a fantastic read. Everyone should go check out the episode I had with him. And I think those are the sorts of things we need to be doing. So if you're listening to this episode, everyone, you aren't running a node, go run a node. We can help you at the Bitcoin way. But Matt, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. I'm glad we finally got to do this.
Yeah,
I'm glad that you're out on the podcast circuit, making yourself known. So really appreciate that. Why don't you tell people where they can find you and Bitcoin University?
Yeah, you can find my channel on YouTube is called Matthew Kratter's Bitcoin University. So if you just type in Bitcoin University in YouTube, that's probably the best place to find me. And I'm also on Twitter at Matt Kratter, MattKratter. And reach out and say hi, ask your questions or suggest future topics for videos, because I love talking about stuff that people are interested in and have real questions about.
Fantastic. Matt, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Michael.
Cheers. And that's a wrap again. Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Matt. Go be sure to check out Bitcoin University. Follow Matt on X. And of course, if you want to be a node runner, if you want to have a decision as to what code you run, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We can help you set up your node, take proper 100% self-custody of your Bitcoin. Also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones. We have a great Plan B residency option in Panama. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can follow us on X at @thebitcoinway_. I'm there as well at @TheOtherMJordan. And until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.